This episode is brought to you by BundleRabbit.com, Earth's most accessible book bundling marketplace.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer. I'm the author of some 27 books, 34 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, and I am your guide on this journey to raise your productivity to pulp speed levels and to explore the cracks and crevices of business and craft in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 610.
Today we hear from Kane, who asks,
how are amazing transitions constructed, from suspense and action to drama and intrigue?
Oh, this is a toughie, Kane. I've actually spent the last 10 minutes trying to figure out how to take a run at this. It's tough because it's hard to verbalize. It would be facile to say the same way you do in a longer story, just with fewer words, which is one of those true but unhelpful answers that you would expect to get from Microsoft tech support back in the day. If you listen to a piece of especially late 19th, early 20th century pop classical, Gershwin, Orff, people like that, you find a very aggressive technique that they use, whereas earlier composers like Wagner and whatnot used dozens of little leitmotifs that interacted with each other and played out sort of virtual stories in the musical space. In the early 20th century especially, that kind of ultra-Baroque style of composition sort of fell out of fashion, and jazz began to, and the root musics that led to jazz, began to influence the way classical composers were doing things. The thing that jazz did was to take a very simple, single leitmotif, usually a popular song or an old standard or a hymn or something like that, and use just that motif as the basis for all the fullness and improvisation and story of the music. Gershwin picked this up in a massive way, and his two most popular tunes, popular classical tunes, An American in Paris and Rhapsody in Blue, both take one or two very simple motifs. In Rhapsody in Blue, it's that up and down flow like the chart of a stock market. That chord progression is the whole song. Everything else, all 15 minutes, is different approaches to that phrase and a little bit of bridging material here and there. That thorough exploration of a phrase of music shows you that you can take the same words, in the same notes in music, but in writing, you can take the same events, the same things that you're describing, and by changing one or two minor elements in the background, you can change the whole tone of what's going on. This is how jokes work. The reversal of expectation at the end that reveals the logical progression to be completely other than what you expected, but somehow inevitable anyway. This is how dramatic irony works, plot twists, all that sort of thing. And the way that you ultra-efficientize that stuff for short stories is, as with Rhapsody in Blue, is in the phrasing. You introduce words into the flow that change the whole emotional tenor of what's going on, and you can speed your reader up, you can slow them down, you can go from suspense and action to drama and intrigue and back again very, very quickly by just changing the vocabulary. This is, it ties into something that I've been talking about a lot recently, where it's what happens between the words that's really, really important. And here's how those tie together. Between the words has to do with the cumulative effect of the words you're using that is not obvious from looking at the lexical definition of the words. Rather than communicating through denotation, the literal meaning of the word, you're communicating through connotation, which is the literal meaning of the word plus cultural or symbolic or acoustical stuff that's attached to it. in acoustical, you create an entirely different impression if you were to say, the moon was bright in the midst of the night. Very clear, literal picture, but the sound of the words is high. Instead, if you said, the moon's glow lit up the night, you have exactly the same meaning, but you have a much more mysterious feel. The word glow, the sound of the O as opposed to the I, gives you a subconscious preparation for something emotionally rounder, more complex, maybe more hidden and mysterious than something emotionally sharp like I. There's a reason that our letters are the shape they are. The sounds they create reflect the shape of the mouth and the emotional tenor of the sound when we make those sounds. It goes all the way back to the ancient Phoenicians and the cuneiform script and the glyphic scripts that evolved in between stages from them towards us through Greek and Latin and Arabic and all the other intermediary languages whose written symbols have melded together and formed ours. And that propensity is the same in any phonetic language around the world. The shape of the letters reflect the shape the mouth makes when you say the sound and the emotional impact of the sound. The sharp sounds, always made by straight lines. The round sounds, always made by round shapes. And the soft shapes, there's a reason that an S looks like a snake, and that sh has a snake and a shape that isn't quite a closed round sound but has a similar emotional feel, the H. And sh is in the same general ballpark as an oo, and so the shapes that they make on the page look similar. And this is true even when you account for all the crazy-ass cognates and phonemes and homophones and homonyms that we have in English from having stolen words from everybody, because one of the reasons that the variant spellings of words that say that sound exactly the same but mean different things persists is that there is a connotative meaning in the shape of the word that would be lost if you merged the spellings. And so people resist and have resisted over the centuries attempts to merge those spellings. So there's the acoustical connotation. Then there is the, let's call it the archetypal connotation. This is the stuff that hooks into substrate, the deep cultural substrate of mythology, and even deeper than that, of biology, stuff that deals with masculine and feminine, stuff that deals with primal things like sex and violence, stuff that deals with God and death and hell and things like that, stuff that hooks in either directly or indirectly to the common cultural tradition that people in a nation or in a large people group share, even if they're not consciously aware of it, because their language is built on it, because their systems of governance are built on it, because their cultural and social networks are built on it. Even if not everybody has heard the stories, in some sense, everybody has heard the stories. So there's that level of connotation. And then there is the temporal connotation of the immediate context in which the writer is writing. This is the stuff that deconstructionists fall all over themselves and ignore everything else. This is what you're intending to convey in terms of, you know, your political subtext or whatnot. You know, the kind of stuff where at the time in the 1950s, coded messages about the Red Scare and the dangers of government overreach were really daring, and you were always thrilled to find these hidden messages because they were taking a risk. And now we look back on them and we go, that is so obvious, I can't believe anyone thought they were coding anything. There's that level of connotation. And then there is connotation from within the story itself, where because of the vocabulary of the characters and their attitudes and whatnot, you can shift around the meanings between the words by changing the words they're using. For example, a really simple one. If they were able to do this consistently, they made a big plot point of it, but they weren't able to do it consistently, which kind of undercut it. But let's assume they did it properly. In Star Trek The Next Generation, Data allegedly cannot use contractions. And when his evil brother shows up, he can use contractions. And it's a big plot point that when they switch places, the evil brother can use contractions, and so the careful viewer could always tell who was who, but the crew couldn't, and the uncareful viewer couldn't, but the uncareful viewer could get kind of a feel of, there's something not right here. Those are connotations from within the story itself. All of those layers together make up the meanings between the words, and you can manipulate the emotional tone of your story, the things that you're telegraphing to your audience, by controlling the language that you're using. Not the words, but the language on every level. The sounds, the pacing, the meter, the syllabic construction, the length of the words, the length of the paragraphs, the words you choose, the lengths of your sentences, the figures of speech. On every level, you can control the way that your audience interprets and hears your narration. Now, if you try to do all this consciously, you'll go crazy and you'll never get anything done. But if you make it your business to understand language on a really deep level, because language is your toolkit, if you make it your business to understand language as much as possible, as genuinely as possible, and leaving aside value judgments, you understand first, you judge second. If you understand second after you judge, you don't understand anything. If you understand, then you don't have to sit around wondering, how do I do this? Because it's part of your vocabulary, your practice toolkit, your understanding of how the world works, you will gravitate subconsciously towards the right language and you'll pick it out. This is how people write in dialect. This is how people write in period voice. One of my great strengths as a writer, according to other writers who are way further along than I am, is that I am really, really good with character voice. You can tell what series of mine you're reading, or what genre you're reading, or what the kind of story is, by just the feel of the words on the page. And you can also always tell it's me, because there's other certain giveaways. But the reason that that's the case is that I understand language, and I am always seeking to understand language better, because that's the only tool we've got in the end, is language. So if you make it your business to understand language as deeply as possible, pay attention to why words are the way they are, to why people use the words the way they do, and to what people reveal about themselves by the language they use, you will be in a much better position to do this kind of stuff effortlessly and subconsciously. And I approach the question this way because, to answer your question directly, in terms of giving you a checklist of techniques to use, is almost impossible. It's a very subtle art, and it's inarticulably complex. But this is the key to that complexity. Thank you very much for the question, and I'll see you tomorrow. The Everyday Novelist is written and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2018 by J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2018 Artistic Whispers Productions. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.